Welcome to ITE 1, Module 3, Part 1.
Alright, so we have a quiz for Module 2 that we're doing today, and then we're going to go into Module 3, which is a step-by-step walkthrough of assembling a computer. I know a lot of you have sent me labs. I will grade them very soon, but last week was ridiculous because I was planning on going to New Zealand. Now I am in New Zealand, and seriously, you're in a different room, Luke, that's why. They will get graded. Don't panic, I am receiving them, and when they're all graded, I'll send a message to announce list, and that'll all happen. You'll also actually get a task list this week, because I've just been seriously swamped and ridiculous. Go ahead.
You need to be in chat, Eden, if you're not already, because she said quiz.
Quiz time!
Well done, Carol.
So does anyone have any questions before we go into our quiz? Okay, I'll take that as a no, or that everybody's asleep. Which it is actually time to wake up now, because we are going to do this.
You're cutting out at the end of your... We got okay. The qu in okay. Quiz. Just, if you can, quickly just triple-check your microphone's pegged out, and I don't know what your amplifiers are set to, but they may need to go up a smidge more. Okay, question zero. The most popular form factor in PC cases in 2010 is A, AT, B, ATX, C, QMX, or D, BTX.
Answer now.
Well done. The answer is B, ATX. Sorry, I just thought I'd fill in some time while Grace was,
Good job, everybody.
Are all those real form
factors? Your silence time was really good when it was at 3 seconds, actually, I thought. But
I put it up at 3 again now.
Unfortunately,
yeah,
Sean, we're going to get a lot of... We're probably going to get a lot of... in the recording, so it'll be a long lecture, people. Sorry. We can't do anything about that. Because, unfortunately, she's not much louder than the hiss behind her.
Am I not?
You'll do, yeah, but you're not that much.
And if you increase the amplifier, the hiss will just get louder.
So that's right.
It'll be fine. We will deal.
How's my levels?
You're fairly quiet.
You should be louder, Marshall.
Yeah, similar. Are all those real form?
No, NL
Most
Pure, whatever I said, wasn't. AT,
yes,
BTX and ATX
BTX
were,
is.
And then... Yes, and then the other one that I just made up was not a real one.
They do that on the test, too, I think. They just have a bunch of... For the ones that aren't the form factor, they just...
Okay, this should be a lot better.
That is a lot better. What'd you do?
Yay.
You cranked it up to 100%.
That helps.
Yeah, it should.
I didn't before.
Oh, sorry. Well...
No problem, not a big deal.
Well, if you can't hear him, crank that gain, because if you've got your ventrilo on quiet, you won't hear some of our students because they're a bit quiet. All right, go for it, Grace.
All right, guys. So, no. I'm just looking for this quiz that I was just away. Chapter 1. I have a Chapter 2 quiz for you guys. That's what we're doing. Okay. Question 1. What is the minimum level of electrostatic discharge that a person can normally feel? Is it A, 5 volts, B, 1,000 volts, C, 3,000 volts, or D, 10,000 volts? Answer now.
All over the place.
No
okay. D. Yeah, no D's. The answer is C, 3,000 volts. So
that is actually... I was going to say, that's actually one of your chapter tests, too.
That is
in your chapter. Okay, 3,000 volts, 3,000 volts. Okay, so remember that. That is what you can feel if it zaps you. 3,000 volts, and it's in your final. Okay? So there's another hint for the final.
We'll come up with a schoolhouse rock-esque song to help you.
Dude,
A rather shocking.
Well, what about a bit of, you know, if you're standing near your PC and you feel a little jolt, you can assure yourself that it's at least 3,000 volts. Okay, enough of that, all right? Just remember that, all right?
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. I could see very interesting rap songs being made of
that. I'll make the backing track and band in a box. We'll sell those MP3s for 3 cents. And
we'll make a killing.
Yeah, or you can sell them for $30 or 3,000 cents.
Hey, yep, there you go. Three,
yeah.
Yes, how can you remind you of idea. The number of volts you need? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so I have an extra question for the cyber lollipop today. How many volts will harm a computer? And you don't get any choices. So somebody, anybody, just go ahead and write that in. That would be 30.
Oh, why did I think it was 5?
Because that's five the voltage that a lot of TTL stuff uses.
Yes.
That's what but you, that won't harm them.
Sure.
Yeah, 30 volts will harm a computer.
Yeah.
So it is 1,000th of the amount that we can actually feel. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is this where we sort of have an advertising campaign that sort of goes, the static charge that you cannot feel can still damage your computer components, so always utilize an electrostatic wrist strap and ground yourself before repair starts.
Well, you just
Speaking of things that everybody's scared of that shouldn't be, you guys, I have a story for you later about a...
You just cut off again.
About a silence?
Oh, the suspense to kill...
Well, die quietly, Drew.
Okay. Oh.
Oh, that was...
Oh, I'm back.
Oh, there you are.
That was odd.
What was your story? You said I have
Luke,
a story
Luke, did you get disconnected as well?
Nope.
Nope, just you.
That was really weird.
Ooh. Lucky you.
Hey.
So next time the internet breaks, we're going to blame Grace, because even when she's in New Zealand, the internet doesn't work, so it's now all your fault when the internet breaks.
Hey. The internet in New Zealand never works. I've been there, all right.
I have a friend who, when she walks on your light bulbs, they have a tendency to burn out. Maybe Grace
is like
that.
Yes, I've been messing with your hardware. I went onto the router today because we had no connection, and it completely was not connected. No strings attached. No default gateway from the ISP. No nothing. And I'm like.
And then she had a go at me about my cabling, which was done the only way I could possibly do it. Which I pointed out to her and. Hey, look, it was done the only way.
It was done right.
It worked.
It did work. But it wasn't working, and I couldn't get it to work, and the filter was all messed up, so it was really weird.
So was that your story?
No, it wasn't. It was something else that happened to us last night. But we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Stay tuned for the story, I guess.
Yes, yeah, stay tuned for the really interesting story.
Stay tuned for partial excitement, coming next on Kavi.
Okay, anyway. Question two. Which recommendation should be followed first when a fire in the workplace is out of control?
Run.
Is it A? You know what? Funnily enough, that's not one of the answers.
But you know it should
that's
be.
That's the first thing I'd do.
It's the answer
do.
I'm picking.
Get that out.
Answer F. Run away.
A. Try to use the elevators to get to the lowest floor faster. B. Contact emergency services for help. C. Use the company water system to stop the fire from extending to other areas. Or D, try to control the fire with proper extinguishers. Answer now.
Run away,
it
run
would be B.
Away.
Yeah, I agree.
It is B. Do not do the extinguishers. Call the emergency people first.
No, it's out of control.
Because if your clothes start burning and you haven't rung the emergency department, it's not safe to pick up the mobile phone while you're burning and go, we have a fire, okay? So call the emergency people first.
In fact,
yeah, because if you die, then not only are you dead, but also there's a fire that no one knows
about.
I have a question
for anyone. Why isn't it A?
A was used the elevator for the lowest floor for those who have forgotten. Okay, why isn't it A?
Why isn't it A?
Because elevators usually stop during the fires.
Yeah. Or they could, if they're not...
A was use the elevators to reach the reach the lower floors to leave the building. And the reason you do not use the elevators is because the power could be out and the elevators won't work, or you could be halfway down, like in one of those horror movies, ITE horror sort of thing, and you will be stuck between floors in an elevator.
You just
and then
use
you'll be
ITE instead of IE. Sorry, I'm too amused. No, I remember there was
Fatal
a
Air is the only ITE horror movie I can think.
You said, in case of fire, use stairs, and they had it in Braille, and you could feel, like, the little picture of the person.
I'm thinking, like, every fire safety pamphlet ever written, they say, do not use the elevator.
Yeah,
I think the other thing they say about fire is get down low and go, is the other thing that we were taught. So that's why I was sort of joking.
Stop, drop, and roll.
That sounds like a pop song.
It's
when I went to college, they hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah, the pop song
the
has,
elevator
when
hall.
I was in school, it was sung.
And it C is a bad idea, because if there's a fire and you're working on, that you have caused due to IT technician error, the fire is... Could very well, in most likelihood, is electrical, and you don't pour water on an electrical fire. That is not why.
Technically, the water doesn't actually conduct the electricity unless it contains impurities, because water in its purest form is actually an insulator, but as soon as it contains any impurities, it actually becomes a conductor. So there's my useless fact for the day.
Water without impurities? Carrie, this is America.
Tap water, it has impurities, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are going to get fluoride in your water soon.
Don't you guys
don't
have fluoride in yours?
We already do.
Yeah. I'm not sure if they still do. I know they did, and everyone freaked out because fluoride is, as you know, a mind-controlled...
Well, I think it was Australia that's just going to get it, and everyone was going to freak
years.
Out.
We've had it for years.
Somebody recently
I imagine they choked it out and then quietly put it back in a month later when no one paid attention.
Okay, next question.
Okay. No problem. Okay.
But my eyes don't see. Sorry, she just said silence is golden.
Did she? Okay.
That's quite enough.
Yeah, we'll be okay.
You ready, Grace?
Yeah, I was. I don't know what happened to my quiz. It just kind of went away on.
I think the whistle did it.
I think it did.
Just
hey,
you
then it gave me away as well.
1337 whistling.
Oh, good. All right,
of course
here we go.
It was true.
Which two tools are recommended for cleaning a PC? Choose two. So this will be a yes or no. Is it A, antibacterial spray? Yes or no? Perfect, guys. That would be a no. Good job.
Good idea for keyboards.
Yeah, we're going inside the computer, though, at the moment. How about B, compressed air? How about... Yeah, that's absolutely right. That would be a yes, guys. Good job. How about mild abrasive detergent? No. And I actually wonder, is there such thing as a mild abrasive detergent?
Yes, there is. OLC or LOC, which is in our cupboard.
Okay, fair enough. It just seems like kind of an oxymoron to me, but...
No, mild abrasive. Okay, so you've got two types of detergent, just so that people know. You've got, like, mild abrasive that's like OLC or LOC that's based on yucca extract and stuff. And then you've got things like caustic soda that will strip the skin off your bones, and that's not mild, okay? Still got the word abrasive in it. So it just depends on how much caustic soda and stuff is in the detergent as to how abrasive it's going to be.
Okay, next one. A nylon brush.
If anybody said yes, you didn't listen to the static question.
Yeah. And you also probably scraped off a few things from your motherboard.
And you've likely broken your processor.
Yeah, possibly.
Them's the break.
Yeah, all gone. All right, how about...
So that's
How about rubbing alcohol? That is absolutely right. That'd be no. That's not rubbing alcohol. That's not the same thing.
Yeah, isopropyl alcohol.
No problem.
That's what he asked in the chat.
Okay, isopropyl alcohol is a solution of, funnily enough, isopropyl alcohol. Rubbing alcohol is a solution of isopropyl alcohol and liniment, which is usually the stuff you rub on your back and for your muscles. And it's also good for wiping out acne. It's a bit aggressive, but it does work very well. So when you go to the chemist, you want the one that doesn't have the liniment in it. You just want the isopropyl alcohol.
And you could probably get it from an electronics store and make sure you get the right thing.
Cheaper from the chemist, though, Sean, which is why you get the one without the liniment. Yeah, infinitely cheaper from the chemist. The other thing is that the bottle I've got, and I'm not sure whether you guys have got the same brand, but it actually has a picture of an alligator on it.
I've been using it for 50 years before I take an injection.
Yeah, fair enough. But it's also good for cleaning certain exterior surfaces of things as well. But Yeah, don't get the stuff with linamen.
Does it burn with a clear flame, isopropyl?
I have no idea. No. I have the gear to be able to find out. But unfortunately, I can't.
We just need the eyes to find out.
We could ask Mr. Taylor. He might know.
Oh yeah.
Almost assuredly, he'll.
Yeah, he usually burns
about all
most
sorts
things.
Of flames.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, one of my old flames is with him.
No. Oh God. That's bad. Okay, the last one. How about a soft cloth? And not only does this cloth need to be soft, guys, but this is a guess. A soft, lint-free cloth.
I want to know, who actually wants a cloth that generates lint? I mean, there are that many documents lint-free cloth. You know, yeah. Hey, be wrong, buy a lintful cloth. I mean, why do they even bother?
Buy
a staticky.
You could use a towel.
That's not very soft.
Crud accruing cloth.
But it could be recycled lint.
Maybe.
If you need to collect lint, you could just use like a technical lint collector device.
Just stop.
It's called a clothes dryer.
You don't know what you're.
This is a text, so I can't add the trademark symbol.
The sad thing is I actually do have a collection of dryer lint, which is for my survival kit, so that makes it even sadder. But yes, we've got quite a big container of it.
Dude, it's a big Tupperware container, you guys, of lint.
Well, you actually soak it in. You can actually soak it in either isopropyl alcohol or methylated spirits or pine oil, and you can use it for starting fires and stuff in a survival situation. Anyway, next question.
All right, time to come back to the off the garden path and keep going. All right. Refer to the exhibit. Which type of tool should be used to remove a screw? The screw depicted in the graphic. So what we've got here, you guys, is a screw with a straight line through the center of the head. So, you can use a stripped screwdriver, B, a flathead screwdriver, C, a hex driver, D, a Phillips head screwdriver, and answer now. Good job. That's absolutely right.
That's funny. You were looking
I really thought flathead was a type of screw.
Well,
it is a type. It is.
It is. Yeah.
It's a flathead screwdriver. You have to use a flathead screwdriver to take out a flathead screw.
Technically, Grace, the
I've
screwdrivers
always called them straight or slotted.
Yeah, that's right. The screwdriver is actually called a slot or a straight screwdriver, but they are also colloquially referred to as a flathead screwdriver. If somebody says, hand me a flathead, you don't belt them. You give them a screwdriver that would fit into the slot that's in the middle of the screw.
It's a catfish.
Sure.
Indeed.
Okay.
I want to eat one of those.
Me too. Okay. Number 5. How does a technician discharge static buildup? Do they A, touch a painted part of the case, B, touch an unpainted part of the case, C, touch an anti-static wrist strap before touching any computer equipment, or D, touch an anti-static mat before touching any computer equipment? Answer now. Oh, you guys rock. Good job, it's B. You want to touch an unpainted part of the case before you actually start working on your computer, because that is going to ground you and get rid of all of the static electricity that you might have in your hands.
Can anyone tell me why you wouldn't touch a painted part? The paint is an insulator.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, what about the wrist strap and the mat? I mean, is that really necessary if you touch the unpainted part?
Yes,
then?
It is.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Because you're not going to have your hand on that thing all the time.
So you touch the thing to discharge the static electricity, and then as you walk over to pick up the board off the other bench because you forgot it, you scuff your feet on the carpet, and then you belt some components when you walk back. Because anti-static wrist straps aren't very long, so you need to do both, and yeah.
Actually, the touch is just an equalization. And the straps and mats would be for any additional build-up, right?
That is correct. You are equalizing the charge between you and the case, and then the static strap is meant to prevent any future build-up from you moving around and that sort of thing. The other thing that's probably worth mentioning too is if you don't have an anti-static wrist strap and you happen to be working on computer components, I know, it never happens, make sure you're not wearing like a fleecy lined tracksuit or something, because that makes it even worse.
How do you know which part of the case is painted or unpainted?
You can usually feel it, and the inside's usually unpainted.
And if you can't feel it, you would then connect it to something like the power supply grill that is generally made of metal, the fan grill on the power supply, because that's usually not painted. Or once the case is open, as Grace said, you can connect it to the inside, but some people are actually more paranoid than that and they will connect it before the case is open. So usually the back grill of the power supply is a good shot.
And ask somebody if you're not sure to look and find where the paint isn't.
If there's someone there, yeah. Do you need, so does that wrist strap thing only protect one hand or both?
It protects all of you because
it's going to protect your entire body. It's going to neutralize any, yeah. You're plugging yourself into the computer.
Skin is a connective tissue.
The other thing is, and this is one of the reasons why they say you must disconnect your power cord from your computer before you work on it. If you are equalized out and you connect yourself to the computer and your power supply is wired incorrectly, it's possible for there to be a charge on the computer and in bad situations you. So disconnect the power cable when you work on the computer because you do not want it grounded.
Which we should be doing anyway. Disconnecting the cable.
Yeah. Absolutely. It is a total fail if you actually are working on a computer and taking it apart and have not unplugged the power. Okay, how about question 6? Which device is designed specifically to protect computers and electrical devices from excess electrical voltage? Is it A, power strip, B, standby power supply, C, surge protector, or D, uninterruptible power supply? Great job. It is C. So tell me, anybody, why isn't it A?
Because not all power.
What was A? You've got some. That was power. Yeah. Actually, in Australia, and Grace found this out not the hard way. Most power boards you buy for $4.84 at Safeway, Kmart, or Dodge Mart do not have surge suppressors in them. They just have an earth leakage RCD device.
Okay. 7. Which three effects can be observed on computer components as a result of climate? Choose 3. Is it A? This will be a yes or no, sorry. A. Components overheat if it is too hot. Yes, absolutely right. Obviously, they will overheat if it's too hot.
Is that the definition of overheat?
Yes, it is true. Okay, moisture damages computer parts if it is too humid. Absolutely. Components work too slowly if it is cold. No.
That's an amusing
not
picture,
at all.
Though,
but they do work too slowly if it's hot, I think.
Depends on the component. And yes, it can, but I mean, we're not dealing with the physics here, and it doesn't usually make that much difference. So things don't always slow down when they get hot. Sometimes they just overheat and fail.
Okay, the risk of ESD increases if the humidity is too low. It does, because think of how you guys are when you are walking down a hall and it's really dry. Aren't you going to get shocked a lot more often?
Yeah,
I guess.
So that is why. So we've got our 3, let's move on. Which condition refers to a sudden and dramatic increase in voltage, which is usually caused by lightning? And sudden is the key word here. A, brownout, B, sag, spike, D, surge. Answer now.
It is C, senora.
It is C. Good job, guys. Because...
Sorry, can I just ask,
because
I didn't quite hear, what was B?
B was a sag.
Right, I thought that's what you said, I'm just like, A?
What is that?
A sag is where the voltage falls 10% below the nominal voltage, and it's where, like, you know, 20 people in your block have just all turned their air conditioners on because it's 90 in the shade, and it actually causes a voltage drop.
So it's a bit like a brownout.
No, it's long-term.
Brownout's a bigger deal, I believe.
No. Sags are actually long-term. You can actually have a voltage drop for, like, an hour until some people wise up and turn some air conditioners off.
I was pretty sure that the brownouts were actually more long-term, but maybe people in America use the terms incorrectly, because they'll talk about the brownouts in, like, New York City and stuff lasting for hours, and I think the sag is actually a little bit more short-term. But
the an actual brownout is actually a situation where the voltage falls for a period of time. The period of time is not generally specified, but it doesn't actually go off completely. So the difference between brown and black, obviously, is blackout is where the power goes out completely and you lose all voltage. Brownout is where the power drops down to the point where the video clock resets, the microwave clock resets, you know, things go into funny mode. But a sag is actually a long-term long-term being defined as more than a second or two interruption in power. So that's the difference between a brownout and a sag. So I'd say it's misuse of the terms.
Was sag actually in the course material? I don't remember reading
it. Yeah, it was. Here, I'm actually going to look this up, you guys, because I'm not actually sure if we're right. But yes, it is in the course material.
Must have slept through it five times.
Oh, it's okay.
That's what the recordings are for.
You weren't the only one.
Yeah.
Oh.
Next see him, Grace.
I spent about 2 weeks replacing compressors when we had a brownout here locally. 90 volts for almost a week in a small town.
What did I say it is, Grace?
Okay. There is no such term as sag in the chapter notes. We're actually talking about a brownout, which is a brownout reduces voltage level of AC power that lasts for a period of time. Brownouts occur when the power line voltage drops below 80% of the normal voltage level. Overloading electrical circuits can cause a brownout, and that is going to last for an indeterminate period of time.
What causes surges?
Lightning.
Surges are caused by lightning or power company problems. Actually, no, spikes are caused by lightning. Surges are caused by problems with the power company.
Yeah, when the power is restored, it surges past the rated voltage.
And if there's a lot of construction going on in your neighborhood, they tend to be screwing with the power lines and stuff.
I think you can also get a surge after a brownout as things return to normal as well.
Yep, I believe that's true. So sag doesn't exist. I could swear it had been in the book, but hey.
There you go. We all learned something.
Last semester, not this semester.
No. I think she's right. It's a term they put in to make you think that it exists, because you think that's a really cool term.
Yeah, it sounds like it sort of could be plausible, but not really.
Okay. All right. Question 9. Which two devices commonly affect wireless LANs? Choose two. A. Blu-ray player. B. Home theaters.
This is a yes-no, Grace.
Hang on.
You're right.
Blu-ray
player.
Sorry,
I just got distracted. Blu-ray players do it. That is absolutely right. Blu-ray players do not. How about home theaters? No, home theaters do not.
Otherwise,
but you know what? I sort of kind of have to disagree. If it's a wireless home theater, it might.
They're talking about the home theater system.
Does it depend on the frequency?
It does. If it's just plugged into speakers, you're good. If it's like all plugged in and stuff, but if it's wireless.
Yeah, but define home theater. I mean, that's anything that makes noise.
I would have thought a home theater could have included a TV, theoretically could have, I thought. I don't know, maybe I'm not.
No, TVs
not these days,
usually.
No, not generally.
Be an old TV. But like if you had a wireless AV receiver, that would do it, and that's usually part of a home theater system nowadays.
Or if you had one of these like pop box or Western Digital live TV or whatever that hooks into the network.
That's just slowing your network down to a crawl. It's not preventing your network from working.
But the actual frequencies in that will might.
I don't think so. Anyway.
What's this for? The okay. frequencies in what?
The frequencies in like
we're
in
still debating
and,
about
and
the home theater that. Entertainment boxes and stuff, and I don't think so. It's not really all that relevant.
No, it is, actually, because I had one that did.
Then you should have taken it back to the store, because they're actually limited for a Class B, Class A and Class B are the two ratings. Class A being manufacturing and Class B being in home, and they're rated to Class B. And if it's interfering with your wireless network, and it's not an AV sender on the same frequency, it needs to go back.
It was on the same frequency, that's the thing. It was yeah. odd. Okay. Okay, how about C, a wireless phone? Absolutely. How about D, a microwave? Yes. And the last one, the last couple, which are pretty common sense, are incandescent light bulbs and hard drives, external hard drives. No. Your microwave?
If you get near a microwave with a wireless headset, you'll get some funny artifacts.
Oh, yeah.
See, it's great. People are like, what's going on? Oh, I'm just making money.
Exactly. That was me last week. Okay, how about 10? Which two computer components contain very high voltages? Choose two. So this is yes or no. A, DVD-ROM. How about B, a monitor? How about... Yep, that's absolutely right. C, a power supply. Absolutely. That is right. That'd be yes. Basically. And, scanners and wireless keyboards? Probably not so much. Those are the last two choices.
Depends on the scanner.
Where is the scanner, man?
Huh?
Do it again.
Depends on the scanner. Send a dollar.
What did you say? Your microphone moved and we couldn't hear you.
That was weird.
Right, so it's unlucky. I said I would have thought a scanner might have.
No.
The
no.
older ones would.
Really old.
Yeah, they'd have to be really old. They're like the HP 5P or something.
Yeah.
Most scanners have a transformer that takes voltage down to 12 or 24 volts before it even hits the scanner, and most of them use cold cathodes. It'd have to be a fairly old scanner. But you never know with blind people. Somebody's probably still got an HP 5P wired up onto their computer.
I have one of these Microtech 12 things, and I only don't have it because I didn't bother to take it to the new house. If I did, then I would still have it. I didn't replace it.
Oh my goodness.
I should. I really should.
Alright, so we're going to go on to our lecture now, unless anyone has any questions about anything from Module 2. How are people doing with their labs? Is anyone having any trouble with anything? I've seriously not checked my email since Friday. So if you've emailed me, I will get to you, unless you want help now, and we can help you now.
Just a note, and I'm just mentioning this because it's pretty obvious, but I'll say it anyway. The labs are not optional, okay? If you find that you're having trouble with 1.4.7, you need to get some help with it, because we are going to take marks off you if you don't submit your labs, just so you know.
And labs? Labs are worth 30% of your grade, you guys. We've ramped it up now so that you actually get some points that you deserve.
Yeah, you guys have
you
a
need
reason
help,
to do them. I mean, I do too, but a lot bigger reason than I do.
You've also got Sean, who's an official member of our voluntary staff now, who is monitoring the instructors list, and what he says goes on the ITE1 stuff. So if you want help, have questions, and
he knows if you've been naughty.
I have. No, he doesn't. But but he can help you out if you guys want help. Since I'm not around, I will be back very soon. So. It's all good, and I'm going through my emails slowly. But I do have 800 emails in my primary email box, so it's a little bit ridiculous. And no, that's no excuse.
I just put my Skype in the chat if people don't have it and would like
I can't do the labs because I'm a jazz.
Okay. now, also, have you said that Sean is actually being trained as an instructor, and soon he will have shiny new instructor qualifications?
Yes, I actually need to... I think there was an issue with the exam activation that I emailed you, but I think you activated the old me, because unless my old student account is still there, I think you got the wrong...
I activated them for everyone. Oh, okay, I'll look later, but I activated all of them. I activated them for anyone in that class, so...
Yeah, I tried to do exploration yesterday, and I couldn't.
Okay, well, Sean's emailed me, and if you email me too, Drew, I'll look into yours as well. I thought I had activated them all, but we can go in and... Maybe the Academy just decided to dump all my active exam settings just because it does from time to time.
Yep. Okay. Okay. Anyway. So what we're going to do today is step-by-step walk through assembling a computer. What we're going to do is... start from the case up, basically, and talk about how we put together the computer, and talk about lots of neat tips and tricks as how to do it as a blind person. So, when assembling a computer, it is important to stay organized and have a plan as to which order you will install components into. So sit down, think about it, hey, if it helps you out, write it out, and where you're going to start from. This is how we're going to go through the way I would do it and the way Cisco tells you to do it. If you want to do something else and can do it safely, then that's up to you. But at least have a plan. Okay, so remember, especially with us, learning to assemble a computer takes practice. The first time I installed a stick of RAM, it took me 90 minutes to do it. Now it takes me 30 seconds. And that was only a couple
of
years ago when I was working. It was just regular RAM.
SD. Or DDR.
It was just DDR2 RAM.
It's a good thing you didn't have Sims your first time.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I can't put those in, man. I've tried. I fail completely.
Well,
luckily, you don't have to worry about them too much.
Yep.
No, so if you're bad at this when you first start, don't feel too bad. You will get there if you practice. Get a cheap motherboard and work on those things. Putting in RAM, doing whatever you want to do, plugging in cables, or just start playing with a lot of Legos. That helps.
Do they make... That would be cool, actually, if you could, get for, $50 a bunch of dead computer components that you could just plug in. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that would be really awesome.
Lego made computer.
Yeah, but you can't get a made to order
university
kit
to get dead.
I thought you went to university.
You might try going to university surplus.
Yeah,
we take all our computers to surplus. The only thing they don't have are disk drives because they have to be shredded.
Okay, the drive. Alright.
How does one shred a drive?
Oh, you mean hard drive.
Hard drives, yeah. You just shred the platters.
Actually, I think they shred the whole drive. I've never seen them do it, but they do have a big
machine. Well, in the department,
do they blend it?
In the Army, they actually have the drive crusher that they drop it in, and it actually crushes the whole drive.
Yeah.
The
cheapest way to reliably completely destroy your data is just a magnet.
What were you going to say, Marshall? You had some...
Okay.
Well, at our university, we actually lost a whole bunch of magnetic tapes of patient data, so they're really paranoid. They insist all hard drives be completely destroyed. Erasing them isn't enough.
Erasing them isn't enough when you have sensitive data.
Not.
Okay.
In fact, there was a printer that had hard drives, and that stuff doesn't get erased.
And just as a matter of calm course, there's actually some recordings up on the www.qcat.org website that has us pulling apart hard drives.
And people's fingers getting stuck between
magnets. And, yeah, there's fun with magnets.
It actually is cool. It is really neat if you like this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And we actually explain things fairly well, I think, when we pull all the bits.
Yeah, listen to that,
actually.
Cool.
feels like the one thing that's like arcana to me, so it would be useful info.
Okay, so before we even think about assembling a computer, we need to prepare the workspace. So we need to make sure we have good lighting. Well, yeah, okay. Ventilation and comfortable temperature. Because we want a comfortable temperature for not only us, but our computers. Because we don't want to expose our computer elements. So we do not go and do our work in the cold, below zero garage in Wisconsin. An ideal workbench is accessible from all sides and has an anti-static mat on both the table and under your feet. I've never gotten the pleasure to work on the ideal workbench. That's what I was just going to say. Keep your space and yourself organized. Use little containers, cups, or bowls to keep screws and small components organized. Make sure that you put all of your components in a safe place where you won't knock them off the table onto the floor, and make sure you know where they are so you're not just feeling around randomly. Use a good toolbox to organize your tools, then you'll be able to find them. And the other thing that I'm going to say again is before you start this, you want to wash your hands. And probably even after you open the case and start messing with the motherboard, you might want to wash your hands again, because you do want to have really clean hands when you're working with these.
And because the insides of cases get dusty.
Yeah. Cases come in many form factors. So what does a case's form factor refer to? Two things.
Size and shape.
Good job. Yes, that's absolutely right. So, not you two, somebody else. What are three components that must have the same form factor?
Motherboard, power supply.
Two out of three.
And case.
Come on.
Oh, well done.
There you go.
Yes, good job. All right. Go. Go you. Okay. So, that is our little bit of review there. And excellent job, guys. So, cases open in many different ways, and we're going to talk about how you can open some of them. Computer cases covers can be removed as one piece, so you've got this big, huge, three-sided thing that has screws in it, and you lift the whole entire thing off. I seriously hate these, because you can never figure out where those little magic screws are to lift off that whole thing.
Just a quick story, we actually had a case, and the screws actually went in the front of it, behind the plastic panel bracket, so we basically dropped this case down in front of this guy and said, hey, if you can get this open, you can put your own computer together, and then we stood and laughed at him for 15 minutes while he battled with it, and then we popped the front panel off and took the screws out of the front edge, and then took the sides off it. It was pretty funny, you had to be there.
Okay, this is the ones I actually really like. The ones where the top and the sides panels can be removed. Because those are pretty easy, and you just find the screws in each panel, or whatever panel you'd like to access. The top of...
flat case.
Or the lovely little latches.
Oh, yeah. I hate the latches. The top may need to be removed before the sides panels can be removed. Hate that. So if you're unsure of how your case opens, you need to check the manual or the manufacturer's website, or seriously. if you think it might be kind of obvious, ask a friendly neighborhood sighted person to help you out and find them, because you're just impaired that way and can't find it, because that happens to me all the time. And it's probably, it's probably just right there in front of me, so I just have to ask somebody.
Friendly sighted person? Usually it's me.
Yeah, okay. Friendly person who is more mechanically able than I am.
In your case, knowledge makes up for sight.
Something like that. I'd like to think so. Just leave me with my illusion, okay?
Or he's opened that case before. It might have something to do with that.
He qualifies as a person.
Still making him.
Yeah, of course he qualifies as a person.
That's Bob, dear.
I don't know if they're still making them or not, but I know Dell at least used to have these, like, screwless design cases where you, like, squeeze the latches and pull them to the side.
I've got one.
2002. I've got one.
Yeah.
In all seriousness...
I hated it.
I was going to say, in all seriousness, there are actually... when you look at things like Dell and IBM and stuff, if you're sighted or you are reading the PDFs, it actually tells you how to open them in the book. Yeah. It actually has like an how to upgrade stuff section.
It's all quite
spelled out.
Yeah, like once and I figured it out, I was like, oh, okay, that's really cool. And I thought it was awesome and I liked it because I was operating without a screwdriver and I was so thrilled that I didn't need one.
No screwing is great in that case.
I was really unhappy with it for the 20 minutes I spent, you know, trying to figure out how does the freak thing open. But once I figured it out, I was like, oh, that's cool.
Okay, Drew, we get the idea. We have some more points to go on.
All right. Next, we will talk about the power supply. Because that's really about all I can tell you about opening cases. oh wait, I do have one tip. If it's your computer, and you can, go replace all of the little screws for the case with thumb screws, so you have easy access. And they are not very expensive, you just buy a whole bunch of them. And there you go. Alright, now we are really going to talk about the power supply. Which we never open, by the way, guys. Never open the power supply. The power supply is a big, heavy box that can usually only be installed one way. Power supplies have fans that vibrate and may shake screws loose, so we need to make sure that all of the screws that came with your power supply are used and you tighten them up really well. To install a power supply, insert the power supply into the case. Align the holes in the power supply with the holes in the case. Secure the power supply to the case using the proper screws. One thing they don't mention is that you want to hold that power supply steady. So you want to take one hand and hold the power supply or get somebody else to hold the power supply for you while you screw in those first couple of screws because you don't want that to fall.
The other point I would point out here is, and it's the same as taking off car tires and stuff, when you're putting a power supply in, put the screws in diagonally opposite corners so that the power supply is held stable once you have two screws in place, and then put the third and fourth screw in the other two diagonally opposite corners. That's not in the notes, sadly.
No.
It makes good sense.
That way it pulls up
squarely. I never thought of doing that.
Me neither. That's kind of what I was thinking, because we didn't.
If you put them on the diagonal, it stops the power supply from swinging backwards and forwards, either from the top or the bottom. So it actually holds it in place and lines it up so that the other holes are more likely to line up. So there you go.
Okay, the next step is to attach the RAM, CPU, and heatsink to the motherboard. Most people are going to disagree with me here, and Cisco even disagrees with me here, but I have my reasons for doing it this way. I will actually prefer to install the motherboard at this point, actually probably even before I put the power supply into the case.
You know why? No. If you do that and you install the motherboard into the case and you actually put the locks and the standoffs and stuff, as you are mounting things onto the board, such as the RAM and the CPU, you will actually flex the board, and this can actually cause micro fractures, which are only detectable via x-rays and will cause your system to be unstable. The reason they tell you not to work on things while the board is still mounted in the case is because that flexing can actually damage the board. So whilst you may do it the other way, you are actually taking an increased risk.
I do.
That doesn't sound like a good idea to me either.
I do, especially when you're actually just I won't actually go and take the entire computer apart to install RAM or whatever either when I'm just doing a RAM replacement. So it's kind of, I figure it's kind of the
but
same sort of thing.
But if you're putting
a
whole computer together from, like, nothing, then I agree with the notes. It makes more sense to put the CPU on, put the RAM on, before you put the board on, just like what Carrie said. You could push down too hard on that board and really, especially when it's on the case, and do some damage.
There is another reason, too. If you're actually putting it together, if you're putting a computer together from scratch, okay, if you're doing a RAM upgrade and you reach in and flick the RAM in and out, that's fine. That's easy. But if you're building a computer up from scratch, if you actually do the board first with the CPU and the RAM out on the table, you can actually access all four sides of the board. Also, with some cases, the RAM slots are right up near the top and they're mounted up under a lip near the power supply, and once the board is screwed into the case, you will not get easy access to those RAM sockets, and it can be very difficult to get past past all the cables. So that's the other reason why you put the RAM, CPU, and heatsink onto the board first, because sometimes once it's mounted into a case, think desktop case, some of the drive bays can overhang the bits that you need to access.
Yeah, but it also can be fun to try and mount a board with a big old whopping heatsink on it.
I dropped the power supply and cracked the whole board in two.
Oh, wow.
It can happen.
So how much of an effect do microcracks have on the... I mean, is it one of these, it either works or it doesn't things, or will it work, but
no, it's,
cause
it will be
performance
intermittent.
Issue?
It's intermittent, depending on the... Yeah, the vibrations and stuff can cause it to work and not work, and sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't, depending on how hot or cold it is, and it's just one of those things that's really difficult to track down.
Would it, like, cause blue screens, or would it just slow the thing down, or is it just random when it...
Could do all of those.
Yeah,
could do
random
anything.
Reboots, slow down, blue screen. But yeah, no, that's why I do it, because I just find that mounting is easier at that point.
It's actually possible that with some cases it's actually impossible to install those components once the board is in the case because of the way the case is designed. You can't get your hands in under some ledges. That little box of mine is like that, Grace. If you don't mount the stuff on the board first, you can't actually reach in to put it in.
Oh, that thing's tiny.
Okay, let's move on.
Alright. So,
anyway, we are putting the stuff on before we put the board in for this example.
For the
test,
we are.
That's, yeah.
And Grace
test,
is not building your computer, okay? So we're doing it the Cisco way.
No, exactly. No, I was just saying that's what I do, but for the notes, it's exactly, you want to do it this way. You want to actually put everything on before. So the first thing we're actually going to put on is the CPU. So before you touch the CPU, you want to go and you want to wash your hands. And you want to dry them really, really well. Because your CPU is actually very, very sensitive, and you don't want to get any dust or anything on it. And you want to try as hard as you can not to touch the contacts, because if you get anything on the contacts, it may not work. If your hands are clean and you accidentally touch the contacts, then you might be okay, but you're really trying very hard not to touch those contacts. You also want to make sure to wear an anti-static wrist strap when working with the motherboard and CPU, and if possible, put an anti-static mat underneath of your computer. before you... Go ahead.
Oh, nothing. I just actually pressed it.
Okay. So, what type of locking mechanisms are used to secure CPUs in modern computers?
0 and 40, 0 and 4 insertion force.
That's right. That's absolutely right. It is a 0 and 1 insertion. Zero
is that Brian?
Insertion
what,
force.
What machine are you on there, Brian? You sound all
MP3
encoded.
because I'm actually off in my office, no, it's only after 10 at night because I don't have a light. I'm on my
underwater.
If that thing's got a Realtek sound card in, you need to crack open the control panel and turn off your noise cancellation, but it's all good. It's really no big deal now.
We can understand you.
It's no big
you.
Deal. Well, we can't hear actually,
50,
Grace, but that's
that.
Okay.
Really?
He's gonna sound really funny on the recording, though. Oh, well.
That's all right. Doesn't matter.
That's okay. It's not a problem. But yes, no, you were absolutely right. It's a 0 insertion force socket. So, before you install the CPU, you want to have a go at actually taking that lever up and down and making sure you understand how it's going to work before you even touch the CPU. Once you've done that, make sure you're okay with the locking mechanism. You're going to line up your CPU into the socket, and you're going to take line pin 1 up on the CPU with pin 1 on the motherboard. And you're actually going to, for us, it's 2 cutoff corners. So you're going to feel that cutoff corner, set it down, and then you're going to lift up that lever. Okay, and then we're actually going to talk about the heat paste. If you're working with an old CPU, before you do any of this, you actually want to scrape off any of the old alcohol.
Cutting in and out.
Okay, sorry. Is that better?
We won't know until you say more.
Okay.
What do you scrape
with?
What
we do... I think possibly you're going to use a razor blade. That's how we apply it. So you're probably going to take it off the same way, possibly using a razor blade. Or... I'm not actually sure besides that what you'd use. Anyone have any good ideas for how you might get old?
Do the compound applicating things come with something to get old compound off as well?
Not generally.
You do.
Yeah, does the isopropyl alcohol dissolve it?
I think you have to get rid of the residue after you've used the isopropyl alcohol to release the bind on the processor.
That is a good point, though. It doesn't really say how to do that.
Yeah, you got to use the JAWS cursor, and you go across to the microphone tab, and left-click on the microphone tab. If you're using Windows, replace whatever I said with mouse cursor. And then once you've clicked on the microphone tab, if you tab, it'll be really sluggish, but it will say EC checkbox not checked, and then it'll say NS checkbox not checked. Or you can JAWS cursor down to the graphics to the left of those two things, and left-click. Or if you can't be bothered, you can just sit and listen and relax.
And talk. You're welcome to talk. We can still sort of understand you. It's no problem. No, it really doesn't give you many suggestions on how you're actually going to do this. It says it removes all traces of the thermal compound, but I do think you have to actually clean it off.
It honestly depends on what state the thermal compound is in. If it's a new thermal compound, you can probably just... you know, scrape it off easily with a razor blade. If it's old, sort of crusty stuff, you tend to have to use isopropyl alcohol and a razor blade. Some people use a tissue or a Kleenex. Not that that's recommended in the notes, because it's not lint-free. But just basically, the key is you just got to get the stuff off. So as long as you don't damage the surface of the processor, something that will take it off is what you'll do.
I've never
Go ahead.
I've never actually seen a CPU. So you say, with the heatsink, I guess, it would be a big box with a square cut-off corner, or not as big as the power
supply,
I take
it? No. The CPU is a tiny, thin, square chip. Because the heatsink isn't actually on the CPU yet. What you've got is this thing in a little anti-static container, smaller than my palm, maybe... about the size of my palm, just this little square chip that goes into a socket.
Oh, okay. So, and I guess the socket would look something like the RAM sockets.
No, it actually doesn't. It's just a flat socket, like just a flat square, on your computer.
Seriously, if you've got some friends that have like a dicey old 486, see if they'll give it to you so that you can tear it to pieces. It's a worthwhile exercise. Even if it is a 486, somebody's got to have something in one of those world-famous basements that they can let you take apart, and that would be kind of cool.
Oh, I plan to. I'm going to be at a disability center next week, and I'm going to see if I can dissect one of their computers for fun. It'll be together, so I won't know the CPU from the sound card or the timer chip or whatever.
Yes, you will.
Go look at the hardware discussions that are up on Kavi. They're under Audio Labs, and they're very descriptive, and they'll say this is about this many inches long by this many inches wide. There's three of them. Go grab them. They're good.
Okay. Thanks. I plan to. I will when I've done the other labs.
Well, you don't. These are just supplemental. You don't have to like. You can just listen to these whenever they.
Yeah, you can sit down and listen.
You're doing.
Yeah, they're just helpful to understand what things look like.
Eating lunch or something, if you're really.
Hey, I have.
I just finished a series of books, so that'll work.
Okay, so when you're applying heat paste, it's a very thin layer. You can either just put a little dollop on it and drop the fan on. And that should spread it out. Or you can use a razor blade. That's what actually the person who is helping me do my heatsink do, because I didn't trust him to do it. And you can always make sure you look at the manufacturer's instructions for your CPU as to what type of heatsink you need and how much to put on. Any questions about heat paste before we go on to installing our heatsink?
just like you
I
said,
have one.
Like you said.
What exactly does it do?
Ah, the heat paste is actually designed to sit between the processor and the heatsink, and it is meant to fill up any of the holes or imperfections that are between the heatsink and the top of the processor, and it improves heat conductivity. Handy hint, if you want heat paste, don't worry about those little tiny tubes that you get with your processor. Go and buy the big whopping tube of the stuff from your local electronic stuff, and you'll have heat paste for the next 20 years. That's what we did anyway.
And it's like Grace was saying, if you don't feel comfortable doing it, especially, I get the impression that that's something that a sighted person might be better off doing. If you have a sighted person that you think can do it and you don't feel comfortable, maybe get them to help with that.
You can also get either fans or heatsink or CPUs, heatsinks or CPUs that have it already done for you. So you can try that as well if you'd like.
Yeah, a lot of the newer ones actually have like a little sticker you pull back, and then underneath the sticker is the heatsink compound already applied. The other thing to keep in mind, guys, is that without getting into a discussion that can't go on the lecture recording, heatsink compound is silicon-based, which means that it is not water-soluble. And if anybody's used anything else that's silicon-based, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, just keep in mind that it's not water-soluble. So it will get on your fingers and it will stick, and it is quite difficult to get off.
The stuff's very effective. We used different but the same stuff doing refrigeration work to keep a joint from overheating when you're brazing it.
Okay, next we're going to talk about the heat sink. What does it do? Can anyone tell me what why we need a heat sink and what it does?
It draws the heat away from the processor to keep it cool.
That's right. Okay. The heat sink slash fan assembly usually has a 3-pin power connector, which you're going to plug in somewhere on the motherboard usually. And there's actually a diagram that shows those headers. So to actually install a CPU and heatsink, as I said, we line up pin 1, which is the cutoff corner, and this ensures that the orientation notches on the CPU are aligned with the orientation key on the CPU socket. You place the CPU gently into the socket. Remember, this is zero insertion force. You do not need to push it down on those pins. Go ahead. Just wanted to say something to say. You then, of course, you apply your thermal paste, as we said, and then you take your heat sink slash fan assembly and align the tabs with the holes on the motherboard. Place the heat sink slash fan assembly onto the CPU socket very gently. And you don't want to pinch the fan wire. You tighten the heatsink retainers to secure it. Usually you just twist them each, and they kind of lock into place. You can connect the cable to the motherboard headers, and that's what you've got going on. Any questions on how to do that? How far does which move?
The CPU one, you're placing it in the socket.
It's not going to move. You're going to set it down, and then it's going to, you're going to pull up that load lever, and it's going to kind of snap down.
Pull down the load level. The lever, if you're Australian, the lever, when it is in its vertical position, unlocks the ZIF socket, and then when you switch the lever, give me a lever and a place to stand, and I can move the world, down into its horizontal position, it will then actually latch the CPU into place, and the CPU will not move at all. And then you put the heatsink on the top. Notice that all heatsinks have different retention mechanisms. You need to be aware of what that retention mechanism is when you put it on. The new ones have got those little spinny screw things that are all quite nice, and if you're working on older stuff, it's not so cool.
Okay. Any other questions as to installing heatsinks and heat paste and a CPU? Okay. We're going to go on to RAM. So, can anyone tell me what RAM does?
Random access memory. It just provides memory for things to be operating.
That's right. It provides temporary storage for things while the computer is on. RAM is volatile memory, which means that its contents are lost when the computer is shut down. Typically, more RAM will enhance the performance of your computer. That's why you may be putting in extra sticks. So, of course, we have checked that the RAM is compatible with the motherboard, right? Right. So now we're going to install the RAM. You've got to align the notches of the RAM with the module keys slot. And what you're going to do, the best way to do this, if you have a fingernail, you're going to run your fingernail down the slot until you find that keying notch. And then you are going to make sure that that little keying notch lines up with the little thing that you've run your fingernail over in the motherboard. You've got two side tabs, so you're going to press that RAM down gently but firmly until those two side tabs click into place and your RAM is seated. You're going to just feel along the RAM to make sure that there are no exposed contents and that's all lined up, and that yes, it did really snap into place and you didn't completely make it diagonal, but you checked that before, right? So you have a seated RAM module. Any questions on that? Okay. So now we are going to install the motherboard because we've got all of the components on that we can put on before we put it into our case. Stand-ups are used to mount the motherboard and to prevent it from touching the metal portions of the case. Why do we not want the motherboard touching the metal portions of the case, guys?
Electricity, any kind of tip.
Yeah.
Yep, you don't want it to be conducting electricity and... What about what?
ROM.
What about the ROM? When do you put that on the board, or does it come on the board?
That comes on the motherboard, actually. You have a ROM chip with your motherboard. That will just be on there.
Okay.
You don't want to install any additional standoffs that didn't come with the... your motherboard that don't line up with the holes in the case in the motherboard. So you only want to install the ones that come with your motherboard. If you've got extras lying around, don't do that because the motherboard may not be seated properly and you might get it on some kind of weird angle. So you line up the standoffs. You put the standoffs into the case first, and then you're going to line the motherboard up with the holes with the standoffs. And you're going to very gently set this motherboard down onto the standoffs.
Just a question. Has anybody listened to our assembly, disassembly? I'll answer that question in a second. Has anybody listened to any of the assembly, disassembly videos? Audio recordings apart from Sean?
I have.
Guys, they're highly recommended. If you're listening to this chapter and you're going, what the huh? You want to listen to either Geraldine and I take a computer apart and put it back together, or last year's mob take it apart and put it back together, because it is really insightful and it will make a lot of these things drop into place. Not quite as much as if you have the computer in front of you, but it'll make a lot more sense than the way it looks from the notes.
I found standoff. Geraldine's a little easier to follow, but that's...
It's much easier to understand.
You probably need them. You will almost assuredly need them for the labs in this chapter, because they're going to ask you how many screws
That's what you're going to listen to for when doing your labs.
Yep.
Unless you're doing them on your own and working on a computer yourself, you will want these two things to listen to. You can choose either one to work off of. Or you can do your own. We're very flexible on this. Or, honestly, if you've done this before, you can pretend. But if I catch you and you're wrong, I'll let you know.
Okay, now standoff is... there are two types of standoffs you commonly see. One of them is a hexagonal metal cylinder with a thread on the bottom that screws into the back plate of the case. I usually refer to those as locks. And then there's a screw with a washer that actually screws into the top of that, and the board goes between the top of the cylinder and the head of the screw, and that sort of screws the board in. And the other sort of standoffs are sort of a plastic thing with two round ends and a sort of a flat sticky out bit in the middle. They're a bit difficult to explain. And the bottom end of them slides into these holes in the system board. They've sort of got a fat and then a thin portion of the hole.
These kind of snap in.
No, some of them slide. You actually put them down into the big fat hole and slide them upwards, and they actually slide a bit like those old-style key locks that you often see in really old doors. And some of them, the standoffs don't usually tend to snap into the plate. It just depends on what sort of standoff you're dealing with.
Then I got a really cheap case.
I think from other stories, I remember you telling about it. Yes, you did.
Pretty much a big old hunk of... It was bad. Okay, so now we're going to mount the hard drives into the bays, into the internal bays. Now the internal bays are actually like a hard drive bay, so we don't have to actually worry about aligning the hard drive bay so that it comes out the front correctly. So it's actually a little bit easier than doing, say, a CD drive. And Carol remembers how much fun we had doing these drives, the CD drive and the hard drive. So you take the hard drive and you find a 3.5 inch internal bay, which means you're going to take your hand and find one of the bays that actually does not have a hole in it so that you can stick your hand out through where the CD-ROM drive.
That sentence made very little sense, but what she's saying is that they don't have to be accessible from the front. So there are bays in the case that are accessible from the front with a plate that you can take off for things like floppy drives and zip drives, and then there are ones in the case that are not accessible from the front, which is why when you look at case specs, it will often say 3 5.25-inch externally accessible bays, 1 internally accessible 5.25-inch bay, 2 3.5-inch externally accessible bays, 4 internally accessible 3.5-inch bays, and the internal ones are for hard drives.
So we're going to find one of the internal ones, as he's saying, and you've got these little rails that you're going to actually line the hard drive up with. You will line up the screw holes, and usually you want to use 4 screws for hard drives, 2 on each side, so that the hard drive doesn't shake and vibrate, because if your hard drive is shaking and vibrating and you're copying data, you might have actual problems with data loss.
In some of the cases actually have rails that screw into the sides of the drive, and then you just slide the drive with the attached rails in.
Those are awesome. I actually really like those
cases.
My
Dell is that way. My old Dell Dimension is that way.
I hate it when you get a case like that and you think it's absolutely awesome, and then 2 years after you actually got the case, you then start looking for the rails that you lost, and then you find that they were 3 houses ago, and you can't get them, and then you hate the case, okay? So a bit of a, you know, love-hate thing going on there with cases and rails.
So the best way I've found to actually find the screw holes, is to take your fingernail and bit on the outside of the bay where the screw hole would be, and you just slide the hard drive until you feel a little bit of a dent in the drive, and that's your screw hole. You can then screw in the drive, and when you do the first screw, don't screw it in all the way tight, because you might not be quite in line with the second screw hole, and you might have to move your drive just a little bit to line yourself up. So don't screw everything down completely tight until you have put all of your screws in. Then you're just going to quickly give them the last half a turn to make sure that they're all nice and tight. Does that make sense?
The other thing that's good for finding where screw holes and stuff line up is a piece of plastic-coated wire, like the stuff you get that ties plants up in gardens, or sometimes you get it in twisty ties on bags and stuff. That wire is also good for poking through holes and making sure things line up properly. But it is important, and this is not in your notes, that the wire is not conductive and that you don't jam it too far in, because it is possible to damage components. It's a bit like the rule, the biggest thing you should stick in your ear is your elbow. Sort of similar to that.
Okay, so drives such as floppy drives, CD drives, and zip drives go into external bays, which are bays that are accessible from the front of the case without actually having to go in and remove them. What you want to do with these drives is put them into the rails, and you want to make sure you take one hand on the back of the drive and you push it forward until it actually comes into contact with the front of the case, and then you've got to actually use your other hand to make sure that it's lined up properly, because you don't want your drive an inch outside of the case, right? And once you've got it somewhat lined up with the front of the case, you're going to do the same thing. You take your plastic piece of plastic coated wire or your fingernail, find the screw holes, and screw them in. Now, go ahead.
Sorry, it's probably just me capitalizing things.
Something you want to keep in mind, and this is actually in your test, is the size of drive bays that things go into. So hard drives actually go into 3.5-inch bays, 3.5-inch internal bays, not accessible from the front. Your CD, DVD, and Blu-ray drives go into 5.5-inch external bays. 5.25, sorry. And then your floppy disks / zip drives actually usually go into 3.5-inch external bay.
Okay, so now do it all twice quickly. Just kidding.
They're actually going to ask you about that on the test. They're going to actually ask you which one thing goes into the 5.5 bays, and it's going to be
5.25.
The optical drives. 5.25.
I would say 5.25. It's probably easier to say.
5.25 is easier to say, but you have to remember that it's 5.25.
Okay, could they actually, they don't actually write 5.25 in the test. No, they don't. They write
5.25. No, they write 5.25.
It's usually almost always written that way, but never said that way.
Are there any questions on any of that and installing? Does anyone have any good tricks they want to share as to how they actually install any of their drives? Or does anyone need anything explained? Or want any tips on how to actually do any of this?
I think the key to this is practice. The first couple of times you'll do it, you won't be really good at it. And basically, it's not until about the fifth or sixth time that you actually pull drives in and put them out and all that sort of thing. You figure out the things that work for you. The other thing I tend to do with lining drives up, and it does take a fair bit of manual dexterity, but it's worth it, is that if you have, say, for example, a hard drive in a 3.5-inch bay, you can actually put the screw into the outside hole that's in the case and then slide the hard drive until the hole in the hard drive lines up with the screw. Although you do have to be careful, because if you really put too much pressure on that screw and slide it along the edge of the hard drive, you'll scratch up the side of the hard drive, and that's not very cool. So, you know, YMMV, be careful, and make sure it's gear that doesn't matter when you're practicing to know how to do this.
That's why I didn't quite suggest that one. I'm not even... I don't even quite do that, because I'm afraid I'll nick the hard drive or damage CD drive or something.
Just remind me next week, Grace, your Skype headset just got given to Carol because the cord on the steel sounds was too short.
Because
I don't know
enough
where the extenders for the steel sound are.
My desk drawer.
Oh, well, that's not very useful. So we'll have to bring in some more sets of Skype headsets next week.
No problem. I think we've got two unopened ones.
Okay. We've got five in a box. I found them.
Yeah, I know. The first time you guys do this, really take your time. And if you are going to do this for the first time and you are going to open up a computer and play with it and you've not done it before, I would suggest, even if you're going to use your own computer to do the labs, that you actually sit down and listen to one of the assembly-disassembly labs so you have an idea about what you're in for.
I would probably also say that if... Yeah, I was going to say, get somebody to help you, because if you're pulling your own computer apart and you want to get it back together... the actual Sri Lankan students actually pulled apart one of the new computers they'd bought, that we bought for them, but they had nothing else, so they just had to be very, very careful, and they were quite terrified, but they did actually get it all back together and it all worked. But, yeah.
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say, tell us some horror story about them not working. Okay.
So somebody's got the put the
screw
in the case and line it up with the hard drive working it. I just wanted to make sure that got in the recording.
Yes. Okay. The other advice I've got for you guys, if you're actually disassembling and assembling a computer, is have a really good look at how these things have gone together before. So have a look before you actually take it apart, and even write down any thoughts that you have about where things are located so that you can put it back together all in one piece. That can actually be really invaluable.
Is it worth mentioning that you don't write the stuff down on the computer you're about to take apart? Just thought I'd point that out.
Well, I'm figuring that computer's not on because you've got your hands in the case at this point. A little common sense goes a long way.
Common sense isn't as common as you'd think, sadly.
All right, any other...
Yes, a question for me. I have pulled apart older computers, but I have not seen a way to remove the chip. Any suggestion?
Okay.
Sorry, that's a
CPU. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you manage to get the heatsink off? Did you manage to get the heatsink and fan off?
Yes.
Okay, because keep in mind, guys, that with the older heatsinks, with the older chips, you basically need like six of you, like you and five of your mates, to lean on the end of a screwdriver that has to press down in a very specific spot so that then you can release the clip from the bit that sticks out of the socket, and then you gently ease it out, and then this spring-loaded thing goes, and then you can actually take the heatsink off the top of the chip. And sometimes you have to rock it backwards and forwards very carefully because the heatsink has gone all gluggy and it is really jammed on there quite difficult. So once you've taken that off, to answer Conrad's question, on one of the sides of the socket, on the edge, there is actually a lever. And the lever is a thin metal lever, usually about an inch to an inch and a half long, and it's generally in the horizontal position. You pull it outwards from the socket because it's actually spring-loaded, so you pull it out towards the edge, and then once you've pulled it out, you lift it upwards because when it's actually down and it's spring-loaded, it's actually in under a little retaining notch to stop it from popping up automatically or, like, you know, by accident. I know that all sounds very confusing, so you grab the lever and you slide it outwards towards the edge, and then you lift it up until the lever is vertical, and then you can just lift the chip straight out.
Okay.
My explanations don't seem to make sense to even me when I do them, so I apologize in advance if anybody has any questions. Some of these things are really difficult to describe unless you're actually showing someone how to do it. But sadly, I mean, if somebody wants to pay our airfares, we'll come over and show you. It'd be no trouble.
Absolutely.
If this helps anybody, it's a lot like removing a SIM chip from a GSM mobile phone.
Similar, depends on the retention
which
mechanism.
Depends on which chip.
He's talking about the SIM, like the actual...
It depends on which phone holder, yeah.
What are you analogizing that to? What are you
to
saying
pulling the processor off.
Oh, pulling the processor off. Okay.
Yeah, it can be. I've seen about six different SIM retention mechanisms, so...
Yeah.
It's hard to know which one you're thinking of.
That's okay.
But yeah, it can kind of be like that. I've seen ones that would kind of apply. Okay. We are going to talk about adapter cards next. Why would you put an adapter card into your computer, guys?
Improve performance.
Add in what
functionality.
Way? Yeah.
Well, there are some video cards, for example, that have higher resolution than probably the ones that were built into your motherboard. So.
Okay, fair enough. That's a good answer. Absolutely right. So we're going to put these in to improve functionality, maybe get a video card that's better than the one we've got, or put a new feature into our computer. Maybe we want wireless, so we'll put a wireless card in. You've got long, thin slots of varying differences. Usually in a computer nowadays, you'll see PCI slots, PCIe slots, which is PCI Express, of X1, X4, X8, and X16 varieties. X1 will be your smallest, X16 will be your longest, and someone will have something to say?
I was just going to say that X1 devices can... The slots for the X1 for 8 and 16 They're actually backwards compatible, so if you've got an X1 device, you can actually stick it in the very left-hand side of an X16 slot, or in the left-hand side of an X8 slot. If you've got an X4 device, it can go into a slot that's X8 or X16. Sorry, somebody else was going to say something, but I thought that was worth mentioning.
I knew there was something like that.
That's a weird noise, Sean.
That wasn't me.
That was somebody else who was keying up.
Yeah, I'm on Logitech. I don't know, that was strange. I'm on the wired.
It's always good to be wired for lecture, I find.
It's me.
Oh. Okay.
Interesting diversion.
Okay, so we've got to make sure that the card that we've bought is actually compatible with a slot on the motherboard that we have. So this is why it's important to actually notice those which slots are on your motherboard when you're buying the motherboard. So what you do to install a card is find the slot you want, line it up, use both hands to line up the card, use one inside of the case, and there's going to be a hole in the back of the case where you're actually going to put your card. You might have to break off a little plate or unscrew a little plate to access this hole.
Well, you don't have to break it off.
Line up your card so that the external ports are actually sticking outside of that little hole so you can access them. Then you're going to push very gently down onto your card until it snaps into place. And there's a little screw right up on top. How do I explain it? There's this little ledge where all of your PCI/PCI Express cards are actually screwed in. You find the screw hole on that ledge and screw it down with one tiny little screw, and there you go, you've got your card installed. You don't have to usually plug these cards into any extra power or plug any cables into the motherboard.
Actually, some PCI Express video cards especially, and some PCI Express cards actually do have special power boost plugs that you do actually plug into the power supply.
I was saying normally you don't. I was just going to finish my sentence and say some sound cards and video cards do have some special plugs that you do have to plug in, but most of the time you're not going to have to.
I wish we could just strike the word normal out of IT altogether and just never use it, because it's just, yeah, there's too many things that aren't normal.
Okay. Yeah, but we really can't, because we can't show everybody everything, unfortunately. It's about 10:50 now. I think we're going... Go ahead.
Okay, whoever is keyed up now, you are making noises.
Oh, they've gone.
Unfortunately, none of us can see, so we can't see who's turning green. Well, I think it's green or red.
So, it's about... Oh, let me check the time right now.
10:52.
Okay, so what we're going to do is talk a little bit about the computer assembly disassembly labs. Next week, we are going to run through our cable stuff, our internal cables and connecting internal cables. We are going to talk about booting the computer for the first time in BIOS, have a quiz, and we are going to go through all of Module 4 because it is a very short module about troubleshooting process. So what I want you guys to do for this week is your computer assembly disassembly labs. So that would be, if you haven't done them already, the assembly disassembly, or the disassembly lab for Chapter 2, and the assembly labs for Chapter 3. Now note, there are a couple of the labs that you're just going to read through. There are no questions, no responses required from you. And I think that is the hard drive lab and maybe one or two other ones. Pretty sure the hard drive lab is one of them. Possibly installing internal and external drives, don't have questions, but I'm not sure. Don't quote me on it.
Read them anyway.
No, you don't have an exam. You just have one worksheet.
Yeah, this is this is module 4.
This is 3. We're talking about 3. Module 4.
Yeah, I was just saying that. You had saying you were
going
to do all of Module 4 next week, too.
And there's no exam for Module 4.
That's
what we're saying.
Yep,
yeah, there is no exam for Module 4.
But you will get plenty towards the end.
Yep. Oh, no, they've taken most of those out, Sean. You don't get the combos anymore. They're gone.
The combos are gone?
The combos are gone.
Ooh. Why on earth did I do that one at all last night?
Okay, well, at least I don't have as many to do, to redo.
Exactly, you just get to rip through all the chapter ones, it's great. It's probably because they've been
combined ones.
Yep, no combos. I think they're all gone. What you do get is some exams that are slightly longer.
Yeah,
which
I have
is good
noticed
because
that
it gives you guys more of a shot.
They used to be.
Okay. Any questions on the assembly, disassembly labs, how to do them, any of that?
I noticed something about virtual machines or
Virtual desktop is inaccessible.
Virtual desktop, don't even bother.
Yeah, it's something that you're supposed
your virtual
to be
desktop
able to
is us taking
the
them apart for you.
Okay, but virtual machines, you'll probably want to start using those as of Chapter 5 if you don't want
five.
To work on your regular machine. And we might talk about those next week or something.
Next week. Depending on how long it takes us to whip through Module 4. Really, it's not a long module at all. So we might
or
just
we
have a little
talk
about virtual
social.
Machines.
A lot of people don't get to social.
Seem to come up. That's true. If you do, though, they always seem to come up at some point or another. So
Actually, it might be a good idea to sit down and do a virtual machine sort of
tutorial.
Here's how we unpack it, and here's how we set it up, and if you want to read along
that
with
might
me
be
in
really
your
good.
Book, you'll know it is. But I want to do it next week because I've got Meredith's netbook tomorrow. Well, I'm starting on it today, but I've got to do Meredith's netbook
tomorrow. If Luke and I have time, we're going to do that with his machine anyway, so we might get to that and record it.
Yeah, but Grace, come on, that is a big mite. I mean, look at how...
Yeah, that's a huge mite.
I mean, yeah, we were going to do a lot of things, weren't we, and we haven't done them yet.
No.
Well,
then
you guys can stay up
interrupted.
You can just, like, stay up for 24 hours a day for the next 4 days and get it all done. Just kidding.
Oh,
but
right.
if you do get to it, if you do happen to be unpacking virtual... if you are going to do it, though, Grace, DM it anyway, and then we can slice it up and see if anything's salvageable. Otherwise, we'll redo it when you get back to Perth.
Yep, no problem.
And the interesting static appeared.
That might be Brian. I might be responsible for breaking his audio setup or something. Become
good
disconnected.
Job.
Oh, I hope not. Or David.
Yeah, so do I.
His has been a bit strange.
No, I don't think it's me because I let him queued up there.
No, you're here.
Still sound
okay.
Because
yeah, you're here.
Okay. Yeah, it must be David's setup.
He was working. Maybe the mute switch is flicked on his.
Yeah, that'd do it.
It sounds like somebody's muted. It does. This is quite possible.
Okay, are we done? Should I hit stop?
Yeah, we're done.